Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is 1A. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White in Washington. It's the news roundup. After 2 months and an unprecedented assault on the United States Capitol building, President Trump has finally acknowledged he's about to leave office.
A new administration will be inaugurated on January 20th.
The fallout from Wednesday's siege has been swift. GOP lawmakers are cutting ties, administration officials are dropping like flies, and phrases like impeachment and the 25th Amendment are flying fast and loose on Capitol Hill. It's the first week of the year, and an extraordinary one in American history, so let's jump right in. Lisa Desjardins is a correspondent and my colleague at the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back. Always a pleasure.
Such a pleasure. Hi, Amna.
Shane Harris is a senior national security writer with The Washington Post. Shane, welcome to you.
Hi, Amna.
And Phil Mattingly is a congressional correspondent for CNN. Phil, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Amna. Thanks so much for having me.
So as Congress was inside counting electoral votes on Wednesday, the world watched as a mob of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol building. Congress did ultimately certify Joe Biden's electoral victory in the early hours of Thursday morning, but the riot that kept them from completing the electoral vote count earlier was incited by President Trump, who had directed his supporters to march to the Capitol on Wednesday. Five people have died, and at least 56 police officers were injured. Lisa, you were inside the Capitol watching the proceedings when what's normally a very predictable affair turned very unpredictable. Tell us what happened from your vantage point.
Yeah, it happened really fast. We knew an outer office building, the Cannon House office building, had been breached and went into lockdown, as did another building, the Madison office building. That's essentially near the Library of Congress across the street from the U.S. Capitol above ground. But going through the tunnels underneath, I was checking that out. Things seemed very calm. I came back to the Capitol, spoke to Capitol Police standing outside the House chamber and asked them about the lockdown at Cannon. They didn't know about it. They didn't know that another building nearby was under lockdown. Shortly after that, I walked to the middle of the Capitol, the center doors that face the east front where the protesters were. And I had just spoken to these calm Capitol Police officers, and there I was with just a few other people, none of them police officers, on a balcony watching protesters crash through the windows using an American flagpole and other things to break through that door and ultimately enter the Capitol.
Jane, the Capitol is the seat of American government. And what shocked so many people and was so striking to see from our reporting position outside where I spent the day was just how easily those crowds of people Lisa was talking about breached barrier after barrier and made their way into the Capitol building. How does that happen?
That is a huge question right now, and one that is going to be the subject of, I imagine, a very intense bipartisan investigation when the Congress is back, and possibly by federal agencies, too. You know, I've covered Homeland Security since the inception, really, on 9/11. And after those attacks, immediately after them, as reporters who worked there know well, the Capitol was seen as a terrorist target. In fact, one of the planes on 9/11 had been aiming for the Capitol, we now know. I stood in disbelief seeing these images because that is a fortified structure. They should be able to control people from breaching not only the perimeter, particularly because they knew that this march of supporters of the president, possible rioters, was heading for the Capitol. We'd known for days they were going to be in Washington. Once they breached those outer perimeters, which appear to be very few, it's just sort of baffling to me how they were allowed to get inside. And the images that we're seeing of some officers obviously putting up a very valiant attempt to defend the building, but others where they appear quite lackadaisical. Even one image that, of course, got a lot of attention of an officer taking a selfie with one of these insurrectionist rioters that came into the building. It just really boggles my mind to see this, because it's not as though the Capitol Police don't know how to control crowds of protesters. They do it all the time. They control protesters who are, in some cases, peacefully protesting, in some cases, who get out of hand inside the building. So I have more questions than answers to what you posed, but this is really something that's going to have to be addressed swiftly. Already, we're seeing resignations of security officials in the Congress. I believe there'll be more accountability to come for this.
Well, we know, as you mentioned, those investigations are ongoing, but in your reporting, I'm just wondering, do we have any idea about what led to that level of unpreparedness? As you mentioned, they knew these protests were going to happen, and a lot of people are making the comparison to previous law enforcement responses, particularly when federal agents have been pre-positioned in D.C. and in other cities before things like the Black Lives Matter protest happened this summer. Why didn't we see that kind of same response on Wednesday?
Well, we're seeing some statements now from the Capitol Police's union blaming the leadership, particularly the chief of the Capitol Police Force, for not supplying enough people, for not having enough riot gear and protective equipment for those officers who were there, who in some cases looked to be wearing bicycle helmets. They didn't even have the kind of the riot shields that we customarily see when federal authorities responded to protesters earlier in the summer, as you mentioned. So it seems as though the leadership of the police force did not perhaps allocate appropriate personnel. And certainly, I think we could see from just the fairly flimsy barricades and fencing that were around the Capitol grounds, it sure didn't seem like they were prepared or seemed prepared for the large crowd that, again, they knew was coming. This could be a management failure of pretty serious proportions.
Phil, on top of all of this, on top of what was unfolding in the Capitol building and on the Capitol grounds, police found two pipe bombs and a cooler of Molotov cocktails on those Capitol grounds. Where were they found and what do we know about them?
So still trying to figure out most of the details, but we know the pipe bomb, there was a pipe bomb found near the Republican National Committee. They were found in the general kind of complex area, right? If you consider the Capitol building, the center of a complex, and then you've got office buildings as well. When you move just past the office buildings, you have the Republican National Committee, you have the Democratic National Committee nearby as well. And I think what's so jarring, and this gets to a couple of the points that Shane was making, what's so jarring is that all of these, between the protesters, between potential weapons, between potential explosive devices, were all within, you know, probably a 4 or 5 block radius. And inside that radius was the first, second, and third people in line to the presidency, beyond the president himself. And so I think one of the things that everybody's trying to grapple with right now, and Shane makes a couple of good points, in terms of how is this not so clearly well known. You could read the internet, you could pick up the newspaper and know what was coming. But to kind of jump off another point Shane made, when I walked in to the Capitol that morning, I looked around, and I think Lisa knows this well. We all know the Capitol Police pretty well. We're on first name basis with a lot of them. Said hi to them as I walked in, and I looked around and I thought, you know, the way this is set up, the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett had stronger security, had bigger fencing, had a wider perimeter than what we saw going into Wednesday. At least that was my vantage point as I was walking into the Capitol building. And I think kind of also to Lisa's point, what was amazing was how fast it happened. You know, clearly they were unprepared. Capitol Police I talked to in the aftermath and some during said, look, we were just overwhelmed. We were overwhelmed so fast that there was barely any time to react and we were very unprepared. But the other thing too was just how quickly it happened. You know, like Lisa, I was getting the alerts from staff saying, hey, we're being told to evacuate Cannon. Hey, we're being told to evacuate another building as well. And so I shot down the steps from my vantage point in the Capitol building and was running underground to Russell office building where we have a camera to do a live shot in case something happened. And by the time I got to Russell, you could look out across onto the Capitol and to see not dozens, not hundreds, but thousands of people scaling steps as all this was happening, not just scaling steps to the inaugural platform. I was on the east side of the Capitol, seeing them banging on the doors to get into the Senate chamber. Look, I've covered the Capitol for 13, 14 years now. It's positively surreal that anyone was within 100 feet or 100 yards of the Capitol building, let alone had climbed to the top of those steps.
Surreal. That is a word we've been hearing a lot these past few days. Lisa, there are now growing calls to hold President Trump accountable for inciting violence and even to move to remove him from office. Among those pressing for accountability are Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The gleeful desecration of the U.S. Capitol, which is the temple of our American democracy, and the violence targeting Congress are horrors that will forever stain our nation's history, instigated by the President of the United States. That's why it's such a stain. In calling for this seditious act, the President has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people. I join the Senate Democratic leader in calling on the Vice President to remove this President by immediately invoking the 25th Amendment. If the Vice President and the Cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And a quick note of clarification, I meant to say the incoming Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, of course. But Lisa, this 25th Amendment phrase we're now hearing, Vice President Pence would need to act to enact that. What would that effectively do and what has to happen?
Right. That would remove the president. And that requires the cabinet officials to sign on to the removal. But as we see, we already have two cabinet officers resigning, Elaine Chao and also Betsy DeVos at Education. So it seems like they're signaling that they are not enthused by that. And it does look like there is a lot of momentum at the Capitol on the topic of impeachment.
It's the news roundup. And this week, there is a lot of news to round up. I'm Amna Nawaz. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
. 2020 had a lot of us rethinking our lives. 2021, LifeKit wants to help you make those changes, whether they're big or small. All this January, LifeKit will give you smart tips to think through your next decision. Listen now to the LifeKit podcast from NPR.
This is the news roundup from 1A. We're rounding up the week's top stories. Well, President Trump finally condemned rioters in a video released Thursday night.
The demonstrators who infiltrated the Capitol have defiled the seat of American democracy. To those who engaged in the acts of violence and destruction, you do not represent our country. And to those who broke the law, you will pay.
Phil, during the insurrection, President Trump called them great patriots. And throughout the week, he's continued to spread conspiracy theories about election fraud. He's been tweeting about his supporters today. What do you make of the way that President Trump has responded to that attack on the Capitol by his own supporters?
Look, it's been horrific. I don't think there's any question about it. And I don't think, you know, I think that the reason this moment is different now than I think what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, and I'm always very hesitant to make bold declarations about what this means for the president, for the president's supporters, what it means for the Republican Party. But it's very clear we are in a different moment now based on how people are reacting. And there is a very clear recognition that, you know, the people are the usual suspects on Capitol Hill who will either make excuses for the president or will dodge our questions or will run away from people like Lisa when she puts a microphone in their face are no longer doing so. They're acknowledging that the president helped lead to this, that the president is culpable for what occurred. And I think that's a pretty dramatic shift for anybody who's been talking to Republicans over the course of the last several years, and I think underscores the severity of the issues the president is dealing with right now. And that leads you to the explanation, at least that I've gotten so far from my sources, as to why that video was actually recorded. And that was, it has been made very clear to the president by the very few people who are actually still around him, and I can't stress how few of them there actually are that are still around him and talking to him that he may or may not be listening to. And that is, he didn't have a choice. Between the resignations, which we've seen in mass, between the movement you've seen on Capitol Hill, which almost certainly looks like it's going to lead to a House impeachment vote as soon as the middle of next week, this was his only option to try and stem what is a very real tide moving against him to get him out of office, potentially, even though he's only got less than 2 weeks left. And so I think, I don't know the kind of long-term of all of this right now, but I know short term, this is a moment, particularly with the president's congressional supporters, particularly with his political supporters, not necessarily his base. But this is a moment that is very different, based entirely and attributable entirely upon his actions over the course of this week.
Lisa, Phil mentions a couple of key points I want to pick up with you on. We are less than 2 weeks away from President Trump's final day in office. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said if Vice President Pence doesn't move to act on the 25th Amendment, she will begin impeachment proceedings again. I think that's a word a lot of people didn't think that they would hear again in this presidency. What are the chances that that moves forward and that President Trump doesn't complete his term?
Yeah, as Phil said, I think those chances are very strong. Catherine Clark, a Democrat from Massachusetts, said on CNN this morning that she thought it would be middle of next week. Apparently, she's walked that back a little bit. But the fact that she even said that makes me think that is one of the leading plans, and that is what Democrats are preparing to do now. There are some Republicans, Adam Kinzinger being one of them, of Illinois, who seem to be on board with that plan. And, you know, everyone's probably remembering the very long impeachment process. It felt long, certainly, that happened last year. But the House actually has the ability to bring articles of impeachment to the floor immediately. It's a privileged motion, meaning that it can move above all other floor action if the House wants to do that. So the House can move very quickly. The question is the U.S. Senate. Now in Republican control, Mitch McConnell would be scheduling essentially how quickly it could happen. A Senate trial is required, but that could happen. It could take days or weeks. There is complete lateral ability for unilateral ability for McConnell essentially to sort out that schedule as he wants. And one thing to note that's important is that McConnell will remain the leader of the Senate until January 20th, regardless of when the two Georgia seats are certified. Because once those seats are certified, and we don't know when that will be, that could be in the next, we think, days or a couple of weeks. That's up to the Georgia Republican Secretary of State. Once those seats are certified, the Senate will be 50-50. The tie will be broken by Vice President Pence while he is in office, making it a Republican Senate until Kamala Harris begins as vice president herself. So there is a theory here. There is some discussion and some research being done as to whether the impeachment effort, if it is unable to go through a full Senate trial before the president leaves office, if it would continue afterward. Because in addition to removing him from office, there are many, maybe even I would say there are more people on Capitol Hill who want to prevent President Trump from returning to office. And impeachment would do that. It would block him from seeking federal office again. And that is a very, that's a very prominent idea, especially for a lot of Senate Republicans, moderates. But also remember, at least three Senate Republicans themselves are considering running for president in 2024. So this is a nest of complicated politics, but all of them right now seem to be weaving into the idea that many on Capitol Hill want to see this president removed, and at least that he will not be able to return to this office.
Well, Shane, back to some of the national security implications of all of this. When you look back over the events of the last few days, you had the U.S. Capitol being breached. You have officials now pushing for the removal of the president, not to mention on the far right internet, this assault is being viewed as a massive success. What are the national security implications of all of this?
I think the immediate ones are, first, I mean, how our allies and our adversaries alike, frankly, are viewing this moment where not only is the stability of our democracy in question, but our government is clearly at a very precarious moment. And this is not the kind of time, this would be potentially the kind of time that an adversary could try to take advantage of that situation potentially abroad. You could imagine China making a move in a disputed territorial waters, for instance, or trying to make even more of a crackdown in Hong Kong than they already have. Internally, obviously, what you see here is now at least the vanguard, perhaps, of a domestic insurgency that we might have to be worrying about. You rightly point out that these individuals view this as a success. There's already some reporting coming out from people who were there at the scene saying that they observed people saying they wanted to find Mike Pence and execute him at the Capitol. These were not just people having a good time. These were, you know, these potentially crosses into line to terrorist acts. within the president's inner circle, and Phil is right to point out that that circle is vanishingly small at this point. I think there is a real effort being made, as well as more broadly in the cabinet, to isolate the president as much as possible in the remaining 12 days that he has in office. I spoke with one senior administration official who confirmed that conversations were happening about the possibility of using the 25th Amendment. And when I asked him why, he was very blunt. He said, because there is real concern that the president could do something to get people killed. This is a I don't want to overstate this moment, but I think those words speak for themselves. So the security implications for this are they are grave and multiple.
What about the implications just from the actual siege itself? I mean, everyone's been seeing some of these videos and pictures that have been posted. Those rioters broke into congressional offices. There were computers there. There was paperwork. We know that they were posing with some stolen items on social media. What about those people, the risk there and any potential arrests?
Yeah, I think that first there'll have to be some kind of after action to determine, did they get into any classified facilities? Were they able to actually lay their hands on any sensitive information? The committee staffs presumably will go through and do that. The Intelligence Committee staffs, SCIF, their secure facility, is actually kind of beneath the Capitol Visitor Center. I don't know if there's been any reporting that they breached that, but that will have to be taken into account. In terms of the arrest, it's been interesting. The FBI has already put out images that were taken at the scene and were all over social media. These protesters really didn't do much to hide their faces, asking for help in identifying them. And fairly quickly, through a kind of a crowdsourcing effort, a lot of these people appear to have been identified. Presumably, they will be arrested. There are many statutes under which they could be charged: trespassing, assault of an officer. Raises a very interesting question. Would the Justice Department choose to prosecute any of these people under the law against seditious conspiracy? If you read the statute, it very neatly applies to what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. And those decisions ultimately will fall to a Biden administration and their Justice Department.
Well, Lisa, when you look at President Trump's messaging, we know some of his accounts have been removed from some social media platforms, but there's already been talk online by some of his supporters saying they're coming back to Washington, D.C. to protest Joe Biden's inauguration. What do we know about security preparations for that event?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually sitting in my car across the street from the U.S. Capitol looking at the Capitol building right now. I'm on Constitution Avenue, and it is a completely different street than we saw just a couple of days ago. I had the same observation that Phil did when I walked up to the Capitol on January 6th. I said to myself, this is less security, or close to the same, but maybe it feels more relaxed for sure than when the Amy Coney Barrett Supreme Court confirmation was happening. Flash to today, this morning, I'm looking at 7-foot-tall fences. One side of parking has been removed, and there are concrete barriers up now that were not there 2 days ago. And I think the thing that I have not seen in a very long time, maybe since after 9/11, we haven't seen National Guard troops here, many of them at every entrance to all of the buildings around me. They have a very visible presence. And I think we don't know yet what exactly the inauguration will look like. We haven't known. They had very large concerns about the coronavirus and how to have a smaller footprint for that. We expected to have fewer press, fewer people here in general. But the plan all along, and this is something President-elect Biden has talked about, was for him to give his speech on the west front of the Capitol, as is traditional. And we know that the security officials are having to reconsider how they handle inauguration. I think there is very large concern about what will happen there. And especially now, as some of the security officials at the Capitol, the Capitol Police, the sergeants at arms, we expect those leadership to leave. So we're going to have changes in leadership as we have one of the most high security concerns this Capitol has faced in a long time.
Well, as part of the fallout, a wave of resignations have poured in from the Trump administration following that storming of the Capitol on Wednesday. Phil, bring us up to speed very quickly. Who exactly has resigned or say they intend to resign, and what are they saying are their reasons?
Yeah, so we've already seen the Senate Sergeant at Arms, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Repeat, were you asking about security resignations or administration resignations? There's so many resignations going on right now.
I understand. It's a fast-moving story, and there's a lot to keep up with, specifically members of the Trump administration, his cabinet, other senior officials.
I'm,
not at all.
I, I'm, It's been a heck of a last 72 hours.
Sure.
Okay, so we have already seen two cabinet officials resign, as Lisa referred to earlier. Elaine Chao, who's the Transportation Secretary, also notably the wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We've seen Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education. She has resigned as well. We've seen several members of the National Security Team, multiple, and Shane would know better about kind of the extent of how important these individuals are, but they are key players in the National Security Council. I think most notable from my perspective, at least given his relationships on Capitol Hill, would be Matthew Pottinger, who is very well known, very well respected from both parties on Capitol Hill, which you can't say that a lot about a number of Trump administration officials. We just had my colleague Pamela Brown just reported that Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, is currently considering a resignation as well. You've seen a couple kind of mid-level press communications people say they're going to resign. And I think you've also seen, you know, mid-level people at the agencies have started to put out statements saying that they're resigning. And I think it's a very interesting moment as I've tried to kind of bounce off, you know, what are the implications for it? And I think broadly, not a huge amount of implications outside of the national security piece, right? I think you talk to members on Capitol Hill and they have made clear to folks on the National Security Council, to key players, cabinet officials on down in the national security side of things, please stay. Even Democrats who despise the Trump administration want the national security team to stay at this point in time. It's too dangerous to just have the whole cupboard bare. But I think there's also a little bit right now, as the numbers have grown, a little bit of resentment that's growing of, you know, you can't check yourself out of a game with 5 seconds left. granted, what we've seen over the course of the last 3 days is as viscerally bad as we've seen in any administration in a very long time in terms of the actions of the President of the United States. But the President of the United States' actions over the course of the last several days haven't diverged that dramatically from his general posture over the course of the last 4 years. And so it'll be interesting to see how many more occur over the course of the next couple of weeks. But I think I'm also trying to get my head around right now, and as I talk to lawmakers in both parties, what does this mean? You know, how does resigning at this point in time, after everything that's occurred over the course of the last 4 years, where does that put you from a historical standpoint? But I do think the bottom line underscores that why this moment appears somewhat different than anything we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years is even loyalists, even those who've stuck it out since January of 2017, are simply saying, can't do it anymore. We've had enough.
Well, Shane, what about that national security piece that Phil mentioned? Are the officials you're talking to, anything you've heard from your sources, how are they weighing this moment in time?
From sources I've talked to, one concern that they have is, as Phil just put it, they don't want to abandon the ship, as it were, before January 20th. I think many of them are appalled by what the president did. But people, particularly people like CIA Director Gina Haspel or the FBI Director Christopher Wray, these are people who are, you know, try to see themselves as apolitical. That's not to say there aren't politically appointed officials in the national security apparatus. There are. John Ratcliffe, who is the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, is a close ally and loyalist of the president. But my understanding is that all of these people are rattled by what they've seen. I think they question what resigning now would do. Is that really going to make a point more forcefully? Is that what they're really there for? Or do they feel that they have an obligation to stay on and do two things, really, in addition to their job? One, ensure a successful transition to the Biden team coming in. And two, to frankly keep an eye on the president and try to do what they can do to keep him in check.
We're rounding up the week's top stories, or in this case, the week's one big story. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
At Planet Money, we are also grappling with what's going on in the world.
We just don't know, and you're still going to have to decide.
So we call up economists like Emily Oster.
It's like we're fighting the pandemic by having a bake sale or something.
Exactly.
I mean, all due respect to bake sales.
Exactly.
Listen and subscribe to Planet Money from NPR.
It's the news roundup. Before we continue with the political news, we wanted to make room for what continues to be our country's biggest crisis— COVID-19. On Wednesday, America recorded its deadliest day of the pandemic, before immediately breaking that record on Thursday. Yesterday, the COVID-19 daily death toll topped 4,000 for the first time. That is the equivalent of 3 human beings dying of COVID every minute. 5 of the pandemic's deadliest days in the U.S. have occurred in the last 2 weeks. Vaccines are being distributed, but they are not expected to be available to the general population for at least a few months. Meanwhile, President-elect Joe Biden gave a speech to the nation on Wednesday as rioters assaulted the Capitol.
At this hour, our democracy is under an unprecedented assault, unlike anything we've seen in modern times. An assault on the citadel of liberty, the Capitol itself.
Phil, we talked earlier about President Trump's response to that siege on the Capitol. What about Joe Biden's? What have we heard from him?
Well, look, he's made very clear, I think he's aligned himself not just with Democratic leaders, but with Republican leaders as well, that what occurred obviously was like something we'd never seen before, that the president's actions, the president is culpable for what occurred on that day, or now it feels like 2 years ago, I guess it was 2 days ago. but I think the interesting thing is, you know, the president-elect's positioning on this has been very interesting to watch. I think there's no question, particularly when everybody agrees about what occurred, that he came out, made a very strong statement about how this simply can't be allowed to happen, how this isn't who the country is. It almost kind of dovetails with his entire kind of the thesis of his campaign, right? This isn't who the country, this isn't who we are, this isn't what America is. The country needs to unify. We need to move to a different place. I think what's most interesting about where the president-elect stands right now is there has been such a push to kind of ignore President Trump to some degree, right? Like, don't pay attention to the Twitter accounts, don't pay attention to whatever the latest statement that's considered asinine by most people is. Focus on January 20th, focus on getting your administration prepared for what is going to be an enormous challenge, whether you talk about the pandemic, whether you talk about the economy, whether you talk about, you know, name the list. It's as long a list as an incoming president has had for a long time. He is now in a different position right now, as Lisa was talking about earlier, where his Democratic leadership is pushing not to just ride out the next 13 days and move into the Biden administration in control in the House and the Senate. His Democratic leadership is pushing for action now to remove the president. And to this point, the Biden team has said, you know, let the leaders do what they need to do. We're focused on January 20th. We're focused on the administration. But he's in an interesting position because, you know, one of the things that I've been trying to suss out over the course of the last 24 to 48 hours is, you know, if the president-elect picked up the phone and called the speaker and said, look, I don't think this is helpful for my incoming administration to impeach the president again. I don't think this is helpful to put the incoming Senate majority leader in a position to potentially have to have a trial for the president who's no longer the president instead of working on my agenda. I think that would carry a lot of weight. But at this point, that has not occurred. And how the president-elect positions himself as Democrats on Capitol Hill move in the direction they're heading right now is just, it's going to be fascinating because it could come to define, you know, really a decent part of his first 100 days.
Well, Lisa, Phil mentions the Biden campaign. So much of it was centered on this promise to unify the country, right, to be able to work across the aisle. It's worth mentioning, though, there were a couple of senators who were facing a lot of heat for leading the challenge to his election win, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley and Texas Senator Ted Cruz. What does that political future or possibility of working together look like?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because there are many strong allies of the president in the Senate. Another one of them is Tom Cotton of Arkansas, but he broke with those who wanted to object to the election, saying, as some conservatives did, that they felt that was a bridge too far and that was the antithesis of what they believe conservative governing should mean, that was a takeover by Congress when they want Congress to have a more limited role. They felt like that was unconstitutional, the way they were going about that objection. And Tom Cotton actually was at the Capitol today, has not commented on what he thinks about Senators Hawley or Cruz, where they're at right now. All three of these senators have presidential prospects themselves. And I can't stress enough how much that's entering into a lot of people's calculations right now. These Republican senators, their own future is on the line. And for years, the reason that the Capitol has acted the way it has, especially the Senate, is because Republicans have believed that President Trump is not only the leader, but that he was the entire message. He was the Republican Party itself. That going against him meant that they would lose office themselves because they felt that their voters really were Trump voters. Now, with the prospect of possibly removing the president and with waiting to see how public opinion forms on this event, I think all these calculations are up in the air. Ted Cruz is an example of a senator who at one time railed against President Trump, railed against him, and then became his greatest ally. So it seems to me very possible that they switch again. But I think right now the fingers are in the air, which, as everyone on this show knows, sometimes, especially in the Senate, that can take a long time. Things are moving fast, but it's hard to say where these notable Republican conservatives end up.
Well, Shane, meanwhile, the transition does continue, right? And it has already been pretty bumpy at times. What is the latest with the transition? Do we know how it's going in these final 2 weeks?
Pretty bumpy and pretty uneven. I think probably one of the bumpiest rides has been with the Defense Department, where you've seen the president-elect and others in the transition come out and say that they're simply not getting the access that they need. They're not getting the meetings that they need to take over there. There are other places where I've heard it's actually going much more smoothly. It seems like in some parts of the intelligence community, things are going about as well as you would hope. But you can't call this a smooth transition overall, because you have a president who continues to insist that he didn't lose the election, and that really has set the tone. But I think it's safe to say, though, that on the Biden transition end of this, they are, you know, kind of all, you know, organized in a way that maybe we haven't even seen in previous transitions. Everything is systematized, everything is hierarchical, and they're proceeding very deliberately as well with cabinet picks. They clearly wanted to wait to see where Senate control was going to fall after the runoffs in Georgia this week. So now I think you're probably going to see some of the final big positions get filled out with nominees. Obviously, Judge Garland this week. I expect the CIA director to be named fairly soon. But it's just been a very kind of steady and deliberate transition, almost textbook from the Biden side. On the Trump side, of course, it's been the opposite of what you want to see in a transition.
Guys, I think it's fair to say what would normally have been the story of the week largely flew under the radar, and a few of you have mentioned it. The results of Georgia's Senate runoff elections came in on Wednesday. Democratic candidates Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff won those two Senate seats against Republicans Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, respectively. This means both chambers of Congress and the presidency will be controlled by Democrats. Lisa, this news, this would normally be the center of attention this week, whatever normally means anymore. But how significant is this?
It's incredibly significant, even though it still could be difficult for President-elect Biden to get his agenda through the Senate. Even though there are questions about whether, with a 50-50 split, it is very hard for Democrats to get enough votes to change the rules that require 60 votes for everything. That looks like a long shot right now. It looks like 60 votes will likely be required for most legislation, but not all of it. They'll get one shot at one probably big, what we call reconciliation package, and more. So this clears, opens up space for so much legislation to pass, but more importantly, to get votes on the Senate floor. Without this, you probably would not see votes on the kind of significant racial justice legislation that Democrats want to see, the sort of climate action they want to see. And remember, President-elect Trump is proposing an optional Medicare for all plan. So that now, you know, this is the difference between those things having zero chance at all and now likely getting at least votes on the Senate floor.
Shane, when you look at Georgia, for years the question has been asked, right? Is this the year that Georgia goes blue? Is this the year Georgia goes blue? And each time Democrats have fallen short. How did they do it this time?
Well, I think this has been a time coming, and I should say I went to high school in the 6th Congressional District of Georgia, and Newt Gingrich was my representative, so count me as among the people who are stunned to see the transition from red to blue, which I never thought that I would see. I think you can go back to the 2018 midterms, and that's really where you start to see this shift, driven largely by voters in the suburbs, in the places where I grew up and where I still have family who live, where it was just kind of by default people were what we would now call moderate Republicans. And that center of gravity has shifted, and people have become, you know, as they certainly economically successful, but also concerned with many of the issues that Democrats were running on. In the 6th congressional district, specifically when a Democrat won that seat in 2018, it was a woman whose son had died in an act of gun violence, and she began speaking to people, particularly suburban women and mothers in those areas, about issues that they really cared about, and that spoke to things that were happening in their lives. And there, so there's that. There also, we cannot overstate the organizational work of Stacey Abrams and what she has done over the past several years with her group to register just huge numbers of voters in the Democratic Party and to fight against disenfranchisement, which has been systemic for years in Georgia. I think that's just a fact. So the turnout and the mobilization and the organization and also picking candidates who spoke to issues that people cared about. I mean, so it's sort of like no magic recipe. It was just hard work and has turned that tide. I just think it's stunning that the Democrats won both of these races. It was not something that I had predicted. My family members certainly there had not predicted it. But it's something that's been a long time coming. And these are also two candidates in Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff who, you know, were speaking to issues that Georgians care about, you know. No surprise there. And I think that that resonated particularly for them as well.
Well, Shane, as a son of the state, let me follow up with you here on this, because there's another big moment to unpack in this, which is that Reverend Raphael Warnock, who beat Kelly Loeffler, will be Georgia's first Black senator. And we're talking about this, especially after this year of protests against systemic racism, this national conversation about America's reckoning with racism. What does that mean for a state like Georgia?
It's huge. I mean, it's, you know, if you listen to Warnock's speech, he talked about his mother, his octogenarian mother, and the hands that once picked someone else's cotton were the hands that went to vote for her son to become the first Black senator from Georgia. You know, the history of racism and slavery is omnipresent in the narrative of Georgia. Georgians understand that better than anyone. You know, Georgia is the home of Martin Luther King. It is the cradle of the civil rights movement in so many respects. So the historic moment that we saw with Reverend Warnock's election is something that certainly, I think, filled a lot of Georgians with a lot of pride. Certainly, I would consider myself one of them. I'm not a Georgian anymore. But it was really something to see that. And it took a long time, but that moment has arrived.
Well, Phil, election 2020 spilled into 2021 with these runoff elections. From the perspective of the parties, though, what are the lessons that they're going to learn, that they're going to take away from these races when they look to 2022 and 2024?
Yeah, you know, I think what's really interesting is you could kind of use the Georgia runoff as runoffs, plural, as a little bit of a barometer for that. You know, the lessons coming out of November 3rd, which I guess turned into 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th by the time it was all done, wasn't clear cut, right? It wasn't a clear wave. You had House Democrats who expected to pick up seats and not just pick up one or two, but pick up 10 to 15, end up lose seats and be on the verge of losing the majority, barely holding, I think, one of the slimmest majorities in nearly 100 years. And Republicans turned out in November to a level that I didn't think anybody thought was possible. They didn't model it that way, even though they had pretty high-level turnout models, and Democrats certainly didn't model it that way. The big wild card here is what happens to the Republican Party when President Trump is not on the ticket. President Trump was not on the ticket in 2018, and it was a blue wave, particularly in the House. President Trump was back on the ticket in 2020, and in the Senate and in the House, Republicans did very well, and President Trump got 75 million votes, second most votes in the history of a presidential election. Just so happened Joe Biden had 81 million. And then you have these runoffs. President Trump is no longer on the ballot, and Republicans lose again. And so I think the Republican Party, you know, and I'm sure Lisa heard this as well, you know, the fascinating thing post the election in which they lost the presidential election, I didn't talk to a single Republican who thought there needed to be some big autopsy. I didn't talk to a single Republican who thought there needed to be some dramatic shift strategically for them. They felt pretty good, at least on the congressional level, with how everything ended up. Now, I think it's going to be really interesting to see, because you saw what happened in Georgia. You know, Republican turnout was solid for a runoff, but it was still down. Democratic turnout was up. And so what the lessons are is going to be interesting to watch play out, particularly because of the dynamics inside the respective conferences. right, or caucuses on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, exacerbated by what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 days, you've got people who want to leave President Trump completely behind, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is one of those individuals. And so where does the McConnell piece of the party go versus where does the Trump piece of the party go? And the Democratic side is not, you know, this unified kumbaya group right now either. You have Joe Manchin on one side and you have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the other, and Joe Biden in the middle trying to figure out how to wrangle everybody. And so how those dynamics play in the coming weeks and months, I think they will go a long way to determining who's ascendant inside the party, what policy issues are ascendant inside the party. And I think how Joe Biden, who again campaigned on this idea of I'm not very far left, I'm in the middle, I can unify, I can make things happen. How Joe Biden manages that inside his own caucuses is going to be just a fascinating thing to watch.
Well, a little bit of news before we go too. President Trump has now confirmed he will not be going to the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. We have been talking to Lisa Desjardins, correspondent, and my colleague at the PBS NewsHour, Shane Harris, who is senior national security writer with The Washington Post, and Phil Mattingly, who is congressional correspondent for CNN. Thank you to all of you for joining us. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White in Washington. It's the Friday News Roundup. So for the next hour, we'll catch up on some of the biggest stories from around the world. And I think we can all admit to being a little distracted this week. But there have been important developments from Iran and China, plus some big news, both good and bad, from the global effort to distribute and approve more COVID vaccines. Our guests on the roundup this week are Nancy Youssef, who covers national security for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, great to have you back.
Great to be back.
Paul Danahar is Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC. He's also the author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Paul, Happy New Year. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And James Kitfield. He's Senior Fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. He's also the author of Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war. James, Happy New Year. Thanks for being here.
Happy New Year. Good to be with you.
So typically we would start overseas, but the shocking scenes that played out here in the nation's capital on Wednesday were watched closely around the world. And reaction from world leaders was swift.
All my life, America has stood for some very important things, an idea of freedom and an idea of democracy. And I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the capital.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson went further than most, but he wasn't alone. French President Emmanuel Macron was equally appalled.
What happened today in Washington, D.C. is not America. We believe in the strength of our democracies. We believe in the strength of American democracy.
And this from one of Donald Trump's closest allies, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
The rampage at the Capitol was a disgraceful act, and it must be vigorously condemned. I have no doubt that American democracy will prevail. It always has.
Paul, when you look at the reaction from around the world to the events in the U.S. this week, what stood out to you most?
Well, I think there is genuine horror. They're genuinely horrified at what happened this week. But I don't think on some level there's a great deal of surprise that something as as just amazingly awful as this has happened. And I think you see that in the reaction of, as you said, Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron, but also Chancellor Merkel, who's not known for outbursts, but she very much parked blame with President Donald Trump for this. I mean, look, let's be honest. Very few Western leaders are going to miss him when he walks out the door. They have not had a lot of faith in his ability to lead America well. They've not had a lot of faith that he was good for democracy, Western democracy, and relations with his allies. And I think there's just a kind of deep sadness that many of their worst fears were realized this week. I mean, you also saw, you know, countries like China and Russia, I would say slightly in smirk mode. The Chinese talked about, drew a comparison with what was going on in Hong Kong, which was, you know, completely, frankly, not appropriate. And they talked about the fact that, you know, it was very similar, but of course no one died in Hong Kong. And the Russians blamed the US electoral system and the politicization of the media. So you've kind of got the reactions perhaps that you would expect. But honestly, in the West, deeply horrified, massively concerned, and I think looking forward to the end of the Trump presidency, to be perfectly frank.
Well, Nancy, national security experts always say the transition from one government to the next is a dangerous time for any country. America's no exception. You have this added layer of this turmoil of this week. Do you sense that there's that same level of concern being held by some of America's closest allies?
Well, I think there's a feeling of uncertainty because there has been so many tumultuous events in such a short period of time. We were talking about the phone call between Trump and Georgia's state officials earlier this week to give you a sense of the amount of news that we've seen in such a short period of time. And so if you ask the Middle East, for example, there's concern about whether this would lead. We're on a path to sort of instability vis-a-vis Iran. And in other parts of the world, you will hear sort of a concern that is this level of sort of volatility internally going to reflect in terms of in a unstable, unpredictable approach overseas as well.
And what about on the issue of allies? There's been some parallels drawn between the political fate of Donald Trump and his close friend, Benjamin Netanyahu, who we should note hasn't really said anything critical about the president. Nancy, is there a parallel to be drawn there?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was at the Capitol on Wednesday night when the protests were happening. And one of the things you saw was people from around the world, journalists around the world, describing events there. And it was interesting the ways that they would compare it to their own countries or their own circumstances or their own interpretation of democracy writ large. To your specific question about Netanyahu, I think there's a parallel in so much as people see both leaders as sort of contributing to the polarization of their nation, that it's become a very sort of a movement that's been personified, if you will, in a way that perhaps other political movements aren't. And so I think in that regard, there's reason to look at the comparisons to say, what is the consequence of being seen as a driving force behind the polarization within your own country?
James, Paul mentioned this phrase, smirk mode, when he talked about the reaction from China and Iran. When you look at nations and powers that look to exploit vulnerabilities and weaknesses here in the U.S., did this week provide them that chance?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is a great gift to our adversaries and a great shock to our allies, as my colleagues have been describing. And it's a great shock to a lot of people in national security circles here in the States. I talked to two former secretaries of defense this week for an article, and both of them said they've gotten scores of calls from overseas from allies, you know, senior officials who are just shocked and really shaken up that this is the greatest democracy in the world on which they depend in many ways. And so there's that element, and there's also an element in both secretaries of defense, Chuck Hagel and Bill Cohen, are very worried about this interim before Trump is actually out the door, because you know, you have this former White House chief of staff and four-star general John Kelly saying he supports the idea of a 25th Amendment to get rid of Trump because they're just frankly scared that he's so erratic. I mean, we can't overstress the vision of a president basically sicking a mob on the citadel of democracy, and everyone knew what he was doing, but he was doing it in broad daylight. So it's become hard for people to sort of justify this kind of thing. And so they are very, very concerned that, for instance, on Iran, that Trump might want to burnish his damaged legacy by a strike on their nuclear facilities, perhaps, because he knows that President-elect Biden wants to get back into the Iran nuclear deal. Getting out of that was a big part of Trump's legacy. So there's a huge amount of concern in national security circles about what this president will do in the time he has left.
Nancy, if you pick up where James left off there, I know last weekend does feel like a year ago, but there was this remarkable op-ed that was published and signed by 10 angry men. It was almost prophetic. Tell us a little bit more about that letter.
Sure. So this was signed by all 10 living defense secretaries. I've covered six of them. And basically, the letter had three points: that the election is over and therefore the time for protest has passed, and that there's no role for the military in terms of litigating the election. And it was interesting because, as I mentioned, I've covered six of them. These are all 10 very different personalities, different styles, different political parties, and they describe coming together in one day and agreeing on the necessity of this letter. Two of them were served as defense secretary under President Trump. And I think it speaks to a couple of things, that there is a concern about the expectation that some have that the military should intervene in somehow. And I think because the current acting Secretary of Defense, Chris Miller, has never really signaled no military intervention. We've heard it from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of the Army. I think there was a need that it needed to be stated. So it's remarkable in that they felt the message needed to be communicated both to the public, but also to the current acting secretary.
Paul, briefly before we move on, you have covered conflict in the Middle East, you've covered wars. When you think back to the scenes here in Washington on Wednesday, did you ever think you'd be reporting on something like that here?
No, honestly not. I think the interesting thing about what happened, the only comparison I would draw is that I think in the same way Nancy and I covered the kind of uprisings in the Middle East, often the protesters went along to do things and suddenly found that they were able to do something they never thought they'd be able to do. For one reason or another, the security wasn't in place, or the security gave up, or it melted away. And there was a bit of sense of that, I think, on this week, that basically the protesters just didn't think they'd be able to do what they managed to do. And then when they found that they could, they just went for it. And I think that's the comparison. It's basic. A lot of this basically comes down, frankly, to the lack of security, the security failures, because you were always going to get people carrying out some angry protests on that day. We knew it. They even had T-shirts printed saying they were going to do it. And so the inability to stop them doing what they'd always said they were going to do is one of the fundamental errors of what happened this week.
It's the Friday News Roundup, and there's still a lot more for us to discuss. The Iranian government has resumed enriching uranium in one of its underground facilities. The order reportedly came from President Hassan Rouhani. And it again breaches the terms of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal agreed on by numerous world powers. President Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018. Nancy, walk us through what's important here. What is the significance? And help us with this idea that it's increased its levels to 20% purity. What does this all mean?
Sure. So under the 2015 deal, it had a 3.67% cap. And now the Iranian government said that as soon as possible, they want to get to 20%. The reason that's significant is to build a nuclear weapon, you have to be at 90%. Now, 90% sounds like a big gap, but it's much more difficult to go from 3.6 to 20. Once you get past that, 20 to 90 is easier, or so say the experts, so I will defer to them. And so the reason this has caused such anxiety, because this is the biggest breach of by Iran of its commitments under that deal. And so the question becomes, why are they doing it? Part of it, one could argue, is that this is in response to the assassination of its top nuclear scientist. This is when the Iranian government first passed this law. It appears to be a way of building negotiation leverage ahead of the incoming Biden administration. As you recall, President-elect Biden has said that he wants to enter into that deal again, assuming that Iran is willing to comply. And I also think that there's an element of answering to domestic audiences. This came at the same time that there was the anniversary of the death of Qasem Soleimani by a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad, and there were heightened tensions between the two countries. And one could argue that this was a way of sort of Iran reasserting itself, that it wasn't going to be bullied by the U.S. in its push to keep a carrier strike group in the region, to send B-52 bombers. And so the totality of that has led to a really major escalation in terms of capabilities towards a nuclear weapon.
So, Nancy, this is the million-dollar question. What does all this mean about what we know of how close Iran is to creating a nuclear weapon? Or do we assume it has one already?
Well, the challenge is they didn't announce a timeline. They said as soon as possible. Now, they alerted the IAEA of its intentions. So the question becomes whether it can do it in what timeline. Now, to be fair, one could argue that they could turn this back just as quickly. So if this is towards reaching leverage vis-a-vis the incoming Biden administration, you could see this pulled back almost as quickly as the announcement was made. The challenge becomes if you start to see countries seeing this as a real threat or a real movement towards building a nuclear weapon, particularly Israel. Remember, a decade ago when the Iranians were moving towards this, there was almost a strike campaign that was triggered by this. Then you have a different situation. So if it's a move towards leverage, it's a very risky one.
James, Nancy mentioned President-elect Biden's intention of re-entering that nuclear deal. What about the work that the incoming Biden administration is going to have to do when it comes to the U.S. relationship with Iran?
It's going to have a lot of work in its hands, and it's not going to be easy. I mean, a lot of the original restrictions in the Iran nuclear deal are going to sunset in just a few years. So it seems to me that it's going to be very hard for Biden to re-enter the original deal. He'll have to want to try to, I suspect, renegotiate so that it lasts some years longer. But I'm very concerned that the tensions right now that Nancy describes are really being ratcheted up. Again, two of the top Iranian officials and Soleimani and this nuclear scientist have been assassinated. So there's fury on Iran's side. Israel has said that it will not let Iran get a nuclear weapon. You have all these, carrier battle groups and B-52 bomber sorties going over the region. So my main concern is there'll be some mistake, some miscalculation. I do believe they're doing this so they can get leverage with the Biden administration in negotiations. But they seized the South Korean tanker this past week. If they one spark in this tinderbox, this thing could blow up, and it would happen at a time when the United States is very distracted with all of this election drama. So that is my major concern. But in terms of the Biden administration's relationship with Iran, it's going to be a rocky one.
Well, Paul, let me ask you about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Axios reported this week he's preparing to take a very hard line over Biden's plan to return to that 2015 nuclear deal. And he has, according to reports, demanded full control over the policy. What is driving that stance?
Well, he's worried because what he's had in the last 4 years is a president in Donald Trump who's done pretty much everything that Netanyahu could have possibly wanted over almost every policy that Netanyahu cares about, whether it be Iran, whether it be the Palestinians, whether it be the Golan Heights. I mean, basically, he's only had to ask and he's pretty much got it. I think the key point is, as James pointed out, it's that Iran sees America distracted with lots of other things and it wants to bring their attention back to Iran, because the longer that their present situation of economic sanctions goes on, the worse the country's economy gets, the angrier their people get. So I think this is not only leverage, it is don't think you can forget about us on day one just because you've got all this other stuff going on, because we're still here. So I think what we're basically seeing now is kind of Iran trying to force itself, up the level of importance and into the top of the in-tray for Joe Biden, so they're not forgotten about.
Let's turn now to China and this week's mass arrest of pro-democracy activists. At least 53 Hong Kong residents were arrested following raids to their homes and offices. Among those arrested are lawmakers, lawyers, and activists. Paul, these arrests are part of a national security law that was imposed by the Chinese government last year. Tell us a little bit about what we should know about that law.
Well, this law basically pretty much takes away all the guarantees that the people of Hong Kong were given when the British handed over power to China. It was all kind of the, you know, one country, two policies. And China has basically decided that it wants Hong Kong back and it wants complete control of Hong Kong. And this is a very aggressive way of doing it. And it's to do with, you know, Xi Jinping has basically decided that that's it. You know, Hong Kong comes back to China, no more of this one country, two systems. And so what they did today, and the this week, and the fact that they did it in such a dramatic way, I mean, 50 of the most prominent pro-democracy activists all being arrested, all at the same time, across 72 premises, 1,000 police. I mean, that is a statement of intent. There's no kind of kid gloves, you know, incremental. This is basically, let's shut this thing down. So, I mean, this is a really significant move because it basically tells you that China doesn't care what anybody else thinks about what they're going to do in Hong Kong. And if you're in Hong Kong and you're a pro-democracy activist, you're going to be scared stiff about this. And that's the intention. The intention is to snuff out the old protest leadership and make sure that another one can't be formed.
Well, James, Paul mentions the way that this was carried out, but what about the timing? I mean, the law was imposed last year. Why are these arrests happening now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think it might have to do with the fact that China understands that America is absolutely distracted. We're in an ongoing rolling crisis in this country. We're not thinking about China. We're not standing up for Hong Kong. We've got other fish to fry right now. And China, it's using that vulnerability as an opportunity to do things like this. But Paul's absolutely right. There's no more question about, one country, two systems anymore. Hong Kong, as we've known it, in all our lifetimes, is dying right before our eyes. And it's tragic to see, but there's no question that Xi has decided to, you know, to take it in the iron grip of the Communist Chinese Party. And he's been flexing his muscles all around the region. He feels very emboldened by the fact that China seems to have weathered the pandemic better than a lot of Western countries. They're able to put in, you know, much more draconian lockdowns, et cetera, early on, and their economies has come, you know, relatively roaring back. So I think Xi is feeling his oats right now, and I think you'll see more of this. And Taiwan's going to be increasingly an issue because that's a very uneasy a truce we've had for decades as well. And China feels that there might be a moment here of maximum opportunity because the superpower on the other side has been so distracted and under Trump has been so disruptive of its allies that, for instance, China signed an agreement with the European Union leaders for a trade agreement in the last week. A terrible time from the United States' point of view because Biden hopes to rally those Asian allies and European allies to present a common front to China. China sees us distracted and it wants to get as much of the as much ground up it can gain while we are in that sort of period of distraction.
Well, let's look at another important story out of China this week. It concerns a tech mogul named Jack Ma. His months-long absence from public view is starting to worry people. Ma's the founder of the Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba, and since October, nobody's heard from him. He's canceled appearances, and company spokespeople are declining to comment on his whereabouts. Nancy, what do we know about what's going on?
Well, let me begin by just saying a little bit about Jack Ma. He's a 56-year-old, really flamboyant and relatively to other Chinese tech innovators, outspoken leader of the company you mentioned, Alibaba. And Alibaba created the service called Alipay, which was a system designed for making payments by phone using QR codes. And it was so affected, it really made cash almost obsolete in China. Alipay was supposed to spin off into a company called Ant Financial, which was on the verge of going into public stock options. And then Ma went to a conference in Shanghai, and he criticized Chinese regulators and basically said that they are getting in the way of innovation. And since then, he hasn't been heard from. He was called in by Chinese regulators in November, and he was supposed to appear at this African talent show that he had founded, didn't show up, and we started to see stories coming out asking, where is he? The assumption is that he's sort of staying low that he faced a lot of pushback from China. And I think the broader message one can take from this is that while he was at one point allowed to sort of be the face of Chinese innovation on the world stage, that over time and increasingly more aggressively, the Chinese government is saying that no one person or company can be bigger than the Chinese Communist Party, and that his silence and his feeling that he can't speak out is really messaging that not only to other Chinese tech companies, but also to the world. And so I think it's not a coincidence that this push comes as she is pushing to consolidate power ahead of next year's big party Congress, when he's expected to extend his tenure for at least 5 more years. But it's been quite effective because he, more than any other sort of Chinese tech innovator, was allowed to sort of speak out in a way that we hadn't seen. And I think he symbolizes his silencing a bigger push on other Chinese companies and other Chinese leaders that you will not get to be as outspoken as Jack Ma.
Well, for those who haven't heard from him, here now is a clip of Jack Ma being pretty candid about his relationship with the Chinese government. It's from 2014. He was speaking to 60 Minutes, and he made clear he was not interested in doing any business with them.
We never do projects for government. If they come to us and say, Jack, can you help with this? Good, I will introduce friends to you who are interested in doing that. Or if you want me to do it, I do it free for you. Just one, next time don't come to me again. So because of that, we keep very good love relationship with the government.
James, why is the disappearance of Jack Ma significant?
Well, it's significant because I believe it was shortly after that 2000, I think you said 14 clip. China passed a law that basically said any company that is Chinese is basically subservient to the Chinese Communist Party and must share whatever data and technology and information it has if requested by the Chinese government. So he's stating a line there of sort of freedom from government control, that the Xi's government and the Chinese Communist Party has no forbearance for anymore. So his position is more tenuous, given that Xi, again, is closing the iron grip on all aspects of Chinese society. I mean, they are running re-education camps for 1 million Uyghurs. They are threatening their neighbors. They are squeezing Hong Kong. They are in a very aggressive mode, both domestically and internationally, to consolidate power and use its coercive power to consolidate its sort of superior position in the Asian Pacific. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to, and anyone who stands in the way of that vision, even Jack Ma, who, you know, is flamboyant as a entrepreneur in China as you can get, even he is not safe criticizing the Chinese party anymore.
Meanwhile, a team sent by the World Health Organization to investigate the origins of the coronavirus has been denied entry to Wuhan by Chinese authorities. The WHO has been working to send officials to China for months to investigate the origins of the virus, but now it seems like those efforts are going to continue to be delayed. Paul, this has been months in the making. What are the reasons China is providing for delaying the investigation?
I was going to pick up something that James said. I think what we're looking at with Ma is the Russia playbook. That's what Vladimir Putin did to the oligarchs when they got too powerful in Russia. He saw them moving towards democracy. And I think that's what we're seeing in China. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing with the WHO team is China, again, using its power to basically undermine organizations that it thinks may be a threat to it or may criticize it. What they've done this time around is basically said that their visas weren't approved. Now, this is a technique that the Chinese government uses all the time. It does it particularly with journalists. You sit there waiting and waiting and waiting for your visa to come through, and then you don't get it. And the Chinese can basically say, oh, no, you weren't blocked, you weren't banned. It was a bit of bureaucracy and it didn't quite work out. But don't worry, you can apply and we'll get there in the end. This is basically stalling tactics. The Chinese government is trying to tell the world that Wuhan is not the origin of the coronavirus, that it started somewhere else and somebody else brought it in. And by allowing the WHO to come in, they're basically expecting, I would think, that the WHO will say, yep, this is where it started and this is what we need to do to make sure it doesn't happen again. So they're basically trying to throw up a kind of fog of misinformation and trying to keep the WHO out from actually revealing what has happened or what should happen from now on. And I suspect they'll keep doing that as long as they possibly can. And it'll be interesting to see when we do get a change of administration in the White House, to what extent Joe Biden starts getting tough with China and starts trying to drag them back into some kind of appropriate, as they would see it, behavior.
It's the Friday News Roundup. We're looking at the week's biggest stories from around the world. Got some new numbers that now tell us how well or how badly some countries are doing in the race to deliver a COVID vaccine. The metric being used here by Oxford University is the total number of vaccination doses administered for every 100 people in their population. So here they are. For China, it's 0.3. For Germany, it's 0.5. For the U.S., it's 1.8. The U.K., 1.9. And for Israel, it's 18.4. That is 18.4, not 1.84. Nancy, what is Israel doing that the rest of the world isn't?
Well, I should point out, not only is it at 18.4, the majority of that happened within the first 3 weeks of the vaccine distribution. So it really was remarkable. And also that 18.4 is outside of territories, occupied territories, because that distribution isn't happening in the Palestinian areas. To your question, there it's unique in a number of ways. It's a smaller population, smaller geography. And they have a really effective healthcare system that is digitized. And so they're able to reach populations quickly and effectively and in a system that has worked for them. The other thing I would point out is that one gets the sense that there's an enthusiasm for and trust in the vaccine that you don't see in other countries. So I think the totality of that has allowed for a really effective process. And so effective, in fact, that it ended up going faster than planned, and now they've had to slow down a bit to get the next sort of installment of those vaccines in. The other thing that's happened since, though, is there's been another lockdown in Israel because they've seen another variant of the vaccination. So I think it also really gets at some of the challenges that come with trying to get ahead of this vaccine, because here's a country that, relative to almost any other country in the world, was incredibly effective at distributing the vaccine, and yet the vaccine and its new variant presented new challenges.
Paul, what about India, another country very hard hit by the virus? We know this week they granted emergency approval for COVID vaccines. Other than the massive task of delivering a vaccine to a country with a population of 1.3 billion, what's the story around that effort in India into developing its own vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some concerns in India that the approval came too quickly before all the data was properly checked by everyone. There's also some concerns from some groups that of a kind of politicization of the production of the vaccine, in a way that they see that the kind of Hindu nationalist government of Mr. Modi wanted to be seen that India would be, you know, creating its own vaccine. The big thing for India, obviously, is it doesn't have a very good refrigeration system network. So for them, it's important that they have a vaccine like the one produced in Oxford, and that can be kept in a normal fridge rather than transferred around at minus 70 or 80 degrees. So it's important for India to have a vaccine in large numbers that actually can be easily moved around. And that's why I think they've pushed forward with their own plans. I mean, they are also, you know, manufacturing the Oxford vaccine for India and for the rest of the world. It's a big place of manufacture for drugs. But I think, you know, India's got a massive population. It does need to do something. And I suspect that they just felt they had to crack on with it because every day they delayed were lives potentially being lost.
Well, they do have a massive population. And Paul, we should point out India's currently second in the world in infections behind the U.S., a third in the world in deaths behind the U.S. and Brazil. Could this unique positioning, this fact that they are both producing the vaccine there and working to get it out quickly, could that effort catapult them ahead of other nations that are still struggling to contain the pandemic?
Look, I think the big problem that India has is social distancing is almost impossible. You have large joint families in many areas of the country, most areas of the country. The urban centres are incredibly dense, and people are poor. There is no social security system in India that allows people not to go to work. So basically, it's really, really difficult for India to get a grip on something that is this much, this large, and basically is spread by people being together. Because in India, everybody is together, whether they want to be or not. So it's a tough thing for them. And you can understand why they're saying, look, we've just got to get on with this because we can't wait very much longer because, you know, it will sweep through our population.
James, I want to ask you about South Africa because scientists are now expressing concerns about a new mutation of the virus they're seeing there. What is worrying them about what they're seeing in this development?
What's worrying them is that it shows to, characteristics that are similar to the one that we found in the UK recently. And as we all know, and you guys know better than me, that strain has just run like wildfire through Great Britain and caused Britain to announce a 6-week total lockdown again, which is very, very worrisome because the South African strain seems to be, like the UK strain, much more contagious, not necessarily more deadly. But if many more people get it because it's more contagious, then a certain percentage of those people will die. So it threatens to overwhelm health systems. So they're very worried about it. It's already the dominant strain throughout much of South Africa. It's appeared in Austria, Norway, Japan. They've even seen it in UK. So the UK government has banned flights now from South Africa. So we're seeing this virus mutate. That's not unusual. And maybe we're lucky, and scientists think that it's not that it'll be, you know, the vaccines will still be effective against these new mutations, though they're not 100% sure on that. But they're very much more contagious, and that's a very worrisome trend.
James, we talk a lot about places where the vaccine is being approved, places where it's starting to be rolled out. What about the vast majority of places where that conversation hasn't really even started yet? What do we know about how most of the world is going to be vaccinated?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the major concerns was Africa, and it probably still is Africa, just because it's got, as Paul said, a very poor population. They don't have social safety nets, so they can't sort of social distance and stay at home. Now, there have been some reports that Africans are showing more immunity or a stronger immunity to some of these vaccines because of their lifestyle and strengthens their immune systems to a way, and their population is much, much younger than a lot of developed Western countries. So, and as they've seen here, younger people are not nearly likely to die or get critically ill from the disease. So there's a lot we still don't know, but Africa is a concern.
Nancy, I want to go back to you on a point you raised earlier about Israel's vaccination program. Nick on Twitter is asking if we know what is going on with the vaccination program in the occupied territories.
So the challenge is that Palestinian authorities have asked for help from Israel. One of the challenges is some of the vaccines that the Israelis are using require refrigeration for and very cold temperatures that the Palestinian territories can't support. Under the Oslo Agreement, there's an expectation that the two sides would work together in terms of addressing epidemics. And I think for Israel, the Israelis have said that they will help the Palestinians, if for no other reason, out of their own interest. You know, there are thousands of Palestinians that cross into Israel every day, many of them construction workers. And so the challenge becomes, though, when that will happen. The expectation is it'll be months because, as I mentioned earlier, as it is, they've hit a bit of a bump in their efforts to get Israelis vaccinated. And it's clear that until that's all been sorted out, that there isn't a plan to go forward in terms of getting vaccinations to the Palestinians.
And Nancy, if I can ask you about another country, about the situation in France that's gotten a lot of attention. Obviously, they're facing their own vaccination challenges, and the border with the UK is staying shut for now. What do we know about the challenges they're facing with vaccine rollout?
So in the first week that they started vaccinations, they got to 500 people, which is less than ideal, and they've improved since then. Where in Israel, you're seeing a lot of confidence in the vaccine. In France, it's a much different situation. According to one poll, 60% of the country is disinclined to get a vaccine because there's a history there of not trusting vaccines that dates back decades. When starting most recently with the Hep B vaccine and worries that it was leading to other ailments. And so there's been a problem in terms of messaging, in terms of distribution, and so it's been much, much slower. The most common populations within France that you hear who aren't going to get the vaccine are young or people who tend to have a strong political view one way or the other. And so I think it really speaks to how much of a correlation there is in not only France, but I think in other countries, between trust in government and trust in the vaccine.
Finally, they said it would never happen.
To our friends in the United Kingdom, I want to say, parting is such sweet sorrow. But to use a line from T.S. Eliot, what we call the beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning.
That's Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, announcing that, yes, a Brexit deal had been done. So, Paul, what actually happened on January 1st?
Well, the UK effectively left the EU last January, but they had a 12-month transition period, which ended at the end of December of 2020. So we then moved into a new trade relationship with the EU, which was only signed on Christmas Eve. Now, it started to hit some bumps in the road because over the kind of Christmas New Year period, there wasn't a lot of traffic, there wasn't a lot of trade going on. But as we've begun to move into the new year, and as people have begun to start trying to reorder, they've now begun to discover some of the problems of being in a different relationship with the EU. I mean, there was a lot of stockpiling going on, and so we haven't hit that point where we're back to people trying to reach the normal levels of trade. But that will come within the next week or so. And people are suddenly finding that actually they don't understand the new bureaucracy they've got to go through. They don't understand the paperwork. They don't understand the new taxes that they may have to pay. There are people that are complaining that they ordered something before Christmas, but because it's arriving after Christmas or after the new year, they're being hit with a VAT bill, with a tax bill. So I think we're going to have a couple of months, frankly, while the British and the Europeans try and work out how to make this work. And this is only for goods. The problem that the UK has is that it imports more in goods from the EU, so that's good for the EU, but it exports more services. They don't have a deal on services yet. They've only done a deal on goods, and that's still to be organised. So, you know, much of the UK's industry is actually quite worried because it's waiting to see what kind of a relationship they will have with the EU. So it really isn't settled, even though, you know, there's been lots of kind of, it's all over, we can crack on. It isn't over, and frankly, it probably won't be over for a very long time.
Well, Paul, von der Leyen did admit to feeling relief at finally having worked out a deal. But was that really a shared emotion? I mean, this was a moment years in the making. And at the same time, we didn't see a lot of sort of special Brexit fireworks.
No, I think, to be honest with you, there's too much else going on. I mean, COVID is really, really bad in the UK. And that's what's got people's attention. I think the other thing that you have to kind of recognize is that, you know, there will definitely be financial impact on the UK, and it will be negative in many areas. But what people who wanted Brexit basically said was, we are prepared to accept that because we want to regain our sovereignty, in inverted commas, from the EU. We want to, as the slogan went, take back control. So, you know, you've got those who are remaining saying, but this will cost you money. And those that wanted to go saying, we don't care. We just want to get away from the EU. And the consequences of that will now be played out. But it's, you know, it did go quietly. But frankly, no one could go out and celebrate anything on New Year's Eve. So perhaps that's not, you know, too confusing to think about.
Well, Paul, a big question I hope you can tackle in about a minute. But you mentioned the bumps ahead. We know Scotland isn't happy with any of this, right? Do we expect more movement on this push for independence for Scotland?
Well, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, says the last vote was a once-in-a-generation thing and he won't allow it to happen again. The Scottish leadership are saying everything has changed. We want to redo it. And I think, essentially, the way it's going is that there's a very strong likelihood that Scotland will push and push and push for another vote to break away from the UK. And it's going to be a very, very live issue until they get another vote. And I don't know which way it's going to go, but I think the way everyone in the UK is thinking that eventually they will get that vote, And there's every possibility, looking at the polls now, that they will try and break away from the UK.
A lot of news this week. We could have spent many more hours talking about it, but I want to thank our wonderful guest this week for joining me. That's Nancy Youssef from The Wall Street Journal, Paul Danahar from BBC, and James Kitfield, senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. 1A's senior producer is Paige Osborne. Jake Cherry is our sound designer and engineer. And Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR.